Welcome to New Letters on the Air, the literature program bringing the best writers of our time to your public radio station. I'm Rebecca Presson. Russell Banks has written 8 volumes of fiction and short stories. His last novel, Continental Drift, was selected as one of 1985's best books by the New York Times. This year, Harper and Row released a new volume of Banks' short fiction under the title Success Stories. The stories examine the notion of success from a number of peculiarly American points of view. In The Gully, which Banks reads for us today, success comes to a trio of impoverished ghetto dwellers in a most unusual way.
What literally sparked it was a newspaper clipping that I stashed about 10 years ago in Jamaica when I was living down there. Clipped it from the Kingston Daily Gleaner. It was an account of 3 young guys who had gone into business in the ghetto, in Trenchtown, in Kingston, who were murdering thieves and taking the rewards for it back, taking the goods back to the victims of the robbery and getting a piece of it. And they were quite organized, and it was they had been protected by the community. But when I re-examined the clipping, I was struck by the impulse to upward mobility.
Later in our program, the co-editor of the New Letters Review of Books talks with Banks about his work. But first, here is Russell Banks reading his political fable, The Gully.
The Gully. The young man called Freckleface, whose true name was Naldo de Aruja, was a bus driver with a dangerous route, through the gully and along the waterfront to the airport and back, turning around at Central Square where all the buses turned around, and doing it again 4 times a day. He was only 20 years old, unmarried and making good money as a driver, and despite his many freckles and reddish hair, he was attractive to the women, possibly because he had lots of money to spend on taking them dancing, buying them Johnny Walker Red, and giving them little presents, such as nylons and stuffed animals. He lived for the women, as he himself often said. And when he was robbed in his bus in the gully in the middle of the day 2 in 1 week, he was angry enough to kill someone for it, especially after the cops laughed at him and the dispatcher at the bus depot told him that if he got robbed 1 more time this month, he would be fired. "It's company policy, Freckleface," he said. 3 times in a month and you're gone, man." The dispatcher stood in the garage holding his clipboard, waiting for the keys to the bus. "Why?" Freckleface asked. "What the hell good does it do to fire the driver? Tell me that." "Sometimes the drivers are in cahoots with the thieves. Not that you'd do such a thing, but even so, the company's got to have a policy. You know how it is." Freckleface handed over the keys, stalked out of the garage, and went straight to a gambler he knew in the gully, 2 blocks from where he lived, and bought a dark blue .45 and box of bullets. He put the loaded gun inside his lunch bag, and when a few days later he stopped at the corner of Angelina and 14th and picked up 2 men wearing rumpled tan safari jackets to cover the pistols stuck in their belts, Freckleface simply waited until they had paid and sat down, one of them in the rear and the other directly behind him, as usual with thieves, and he reached down to his lunch bag on the floor, drew out the .45, spun around, and shot the man behind him in the eye. The other man leaped out the back door to the street and started running. Freckleface grabbed the first one's pistol from where it had fallen to the floor, stepped over the man's body, and jumped to the street, like Gary Cooper or Clint Eastwood, a gun in each hand. People in the bus and on the street and sidewalks, mostly women and children at this time of day, were terrified. A few were screaming. But when Freckleface took off down the street after the second thief, everyone stepped back and cheered. He caught the guy in a dead-end alley behind a Pakistani restaurant, and he shot him 2, first in the chest and then up close in the head. He took his gun, too, and walked quickly back to the bus, which was still sitting at the corner of Angelina and 14th, with the doors open and the motor running. He climbed into the bus, dragged the body of the first thief out to the street, put all 3 guns into his lunch bag, and continued down Angelina and on out to the airport. He himself never mentioned the event to anyone, but in a short time everyone knew about it. The dispatcher, the other drivers, the people and merchants in the gully, and the thieves. People started waiting especially for Freckleface's bus, letting earlier buses go past. He was extremely popular with the women on his route, who smiled and hitched their dresses up their thighs a little as they climbed the steps of his bus and dropped their coins slowly, one by one, into his hand. No one, of course, mentioned to Freckleface that they knew what he carried inside his lunch bag, and no one said anything to the police about it. When the police drove into the gully to pick up the bodies of the two thieves, everyone on the street denied knowing how the men had died. "Who knows?" they shrugged. "Someone just dumped the bodies there during the night, or maybe this morning when no one was looking. It happens all the time around here. You know that." Over on the north side of the gully, not far from the bus depot, a young man called Chink, whose real name was Felipe da Silva, worked in his parents' bakery with his mother, father, and two younger sisters. One morning when he came into work late and hung over and expecting the usual harangue from his father, he met instead with the aftermath of a massacre. Moments before, robbers had walked into the shop and killed with guns and machetes all four members of Chink's family, plus two customers, elderly ladies from the neighborhood. The white walls, floors, even the ceiling were splattered with blood, grisly maps showing where the people had met their deaths and how. Chink's sisters had been shot in the front room of the shop, where they worked behind the counter, and the two old neighborhood ladies had been killed, each of them shot once behind the ear, just inside the door. They had probably walked in on the robbery. Chink's father had been cut down with a machete at the doorway leading from the back room, where the ovens were located, and his mother, also chopped practically in half by the machete, had been slain near the back door, evidently fleeing from the carnage. Chink paused before each body, examined it for a second, stepped over it to the next, careful not to step into the huge spreading smears of thickening blood and flour, until he worked his way to the back, where he found his mother's body. Opening the door to the alley and back, he stepped out, and when he knelt down to the ground, as if to pray or vomit, he saw several pairs of white footprints that led down the alley toward the rear of the building. Instantly, Chink set off in pursuit of whoever had laid down the tracks. He jogged down the alley, turned left behind the building, and climbed over a ramshackle wood fence to another alley, passed through to a packed dirt yard shared by the backsides of a half-dozen tin-roof shanties, where he followed the white footprints across the yard to the rear of an old dark green panel truck sitting wheelless up on cinder blocks. He tiptoed to the rear door of the truck and listened and heard the men inside counting the few miserable dollars they had taken from the bakery. First, he dropped an old piece of iron pipe into the latch, jamming it. Then he walked out to the street, to a filling station, boldly stole a 5-gallon can of gasoline, and brought it back to the panel truck, where he splashed the gasoline onto the packed dirt ground all around the truck, especially at the rear entrance, and poured more gas over the top and along the sides. Last, he lit a match, tossed it at the truck, and ran. People had watched the entire process from the beginning, and no one said or did a thing to stop Chink. And when the truck exploded in a fireball, the folks in the shanties, many of them mothers with babies on their hips, shouted with obvious pleasure. Later, when the firemen had put out the flames and opened the rear door of the truck, three charred, utterly unrecognizable bodies were discovered huddled inside. No one from the shanties knew who they were or how they got locked inside the truck, or who doused the truck with gasoline and set it on fire. "We were inside cooking food," they said. And no one, that is, no one from the police or fire department, connected the bizarre incineration of the three young men in the panel truck to the massacre of the six people in the bakery two blocks away. In the gully, however, everyone knew of the connection and spoke of Chink with sympathy and admiration, even those who used to think of him as a lazy, drunken playboy supported by his industrious family. Then there was Saverio Gomez Macedo, called Tarzan, because of his great size and overdeveloped physique and the special way he cupped his hands around his mouth and yelled, which he liked to do at the start of every day. He would untangle himself from his hammock on the porch of his grandmother's shanty, stepped to the standpipe by the alley where the people were already lining up to fill their pans and jars with water for cooking, and he'd give his yell and beat good-naturedly on his enormous chest. In exchange for caring for his aged grandmother, who was crippled with arthritis, Tarzan was allowed to sleep on the porch of her cabin. Now and then he got himself hired for day work, hauling bricks or laying sewer pipe down by the waterfront, where the government was building hotels for foreigners. But most of the time, he had no money and depended on his grandmother for everything. She, in turn, depended on her children, Tarzan's aunts and uncles, several of whom now lived in Florida and sometimes sent money. The daughter who was Tarzan's mother had died of cancer many years before, and no one knew who his father was. Thus, Tarzan and his grandmother were as close as mother and son. They spent most of their days and evenings sitting out on the shaded, tilted porch of the tiny cabin, where they watched the people pass on the street, and chatted and gossiped about the old days and people they used to know. Despite his great size and obvious high spirits, Tarzan was in many ways like a little old man, which of course delighted his grandmother and amused everyone in the neighborhood who knew them. For that reason, most people were amazed by the transformation that Tarzan went through when his grandmother was killed. Her death was an unfortunate accident, and perhaps they expected him simply to accept it as such, as they certainly would have. But he treated it as if it were a cold-blooded murder. Two drug dealers in the neighborhood got into a scuffle over money, not an unusual event. And while chasing each other down the alleys and across the yards of the neighborhood, shooting whenever they caught sight of each one of them, and it was never determined which one, shot Tarzan's grandmother, who was sitting on the porch waiting for Tarzan to come home from the store. She died instantly, shot in the throat, just as Tarzan rounded the corner and saw the pair of drug dealers dart between cars on the street, still shouting at one another, heading out of the neighborhood into another. He roared, pounded his chest in rage, frightening those who heard him, and took off after the drug dealers. He caught up with them late that night in the back room of a bar out near the airport. Apparently they had settled their differences and were once again doing business with one another, when Tarzan, huge with his anger and his fearlessness, walked into the dingy room, grabbed the two scrawny punks, and dragged them out to the street. It was raining and the street was quiet and almost empty. The bartender and the few customers who were there at the time later described with a kind of horror, a horror oddly mixed with pride, the sound of the skulls cracking as the enormous young man slammed the two men's heads against one another. Then, when clearly they were dead in his hands, Tarzan tossed the pair like sacks of garbage into the gutter and walked off in the rain. After that, because for a while the drug dealers stayed away, but also because of his pain, Tarzan was a hero in the neighborhood. In the gully, true heroes were almost non-existent. Politicians and soldiers had lived off the people for generations, and athletes, singers, actors, figures whose famous faces were used to sell things people either did not otherwise want or could not afford, were because of that no longer trusted or admired or even envied. In the gully, people had grown cynical. It was their only defense against being used over and over to fatten the already fat. They had learned long ago that it's the poor who feed the rich, not vice versa. And finally, when it was almost too late and they had almost nothing left to give to the rich, to the politicians, to the businessmen, to the foreigners, finally the people of the gully had turned away from all projects and enterprises, all plans, all endeavors that depended for their completion on hope. And when you give up hope and do it on principle, that is, when you do it because you have learned that hope is bad for you, then you give up on heroes as well. That is why when Freckleface heard people praise Chink, and then Tarzan, and saw how people admired them for their pain and their rage, when in short he realized that he and the other two had become heroes where before there were none, he determined to capitalize on it as swiftly as possible and before people settled back into their old ways of dismissing heroism as a trick. He organized a meeting of the three in the back room of a cafe close to his rooming house, and when they had shaken hands, each of them slightly in awe of the other two, for they were as unused to genuine heroes as everyone else in the gully, Freckleface got quickly down to business. His plan was to build a watchtower in the center of the gully, and for one of them to be posted there at all times, and when he saw a robbery going on, to give the signal, and the others would chase down the robbers and kill them. "What for?" Chink asked. "For money," Freckleface said. "Who'd pay us?" Tarzan wanted to know. "The robbers' victims," Freckleface explained. "We just return what was stolen and ask for a percentage for our troubles." "It's wrong to kill for money," Tarzan said. "God kills, you just pull the trigger," Chink observed. He was definitely interested. Since the death of his parents and sisters, the bakery had been closed, and Chink was down to panhandling on Central Square with a sign around his neck that said, "Help the Avenger of the Bakery Massacre." Tarzan needed money, too. With his grandmother's death, his uncles and aunts had sold her shanty to a man in the Heights who rented out hundreds of shanties in the gully. Consequently, Tarzan had lately been sleeping under two sheets of corrugated iron in back of a warehouse where he hoped to find work as a warehouse man as soon as his aunt in Florida sent him the money he needed to bribe the foreman to hire him. Freckleface was not much better off. His popularity as a bus driver had cut into the income of the other drivers, and in recent weeks Freckleface had come into work and found sugar in his gas tank one day, his tires slashed another, or a radiator hose cut, a distributor cap missing. Every day another lengthy repair job that kept him in the garage, until he was taking home less than half of what he had been earning before the robberies. He'd stopped buying presents for his girlfriends, and they in turn had stopped turning down other guys. He used to be able to get several women to share him. Now, despite being a hero, he could barely get one woman to wait for him to get off work and take her out dancing. A hero without money is just another man. In short order, Freckleface, Chink, and Tarzan were making more money than they had ever imagined possible. Quickly they had specialized, Tarzan as lookout because of his ability to call out the location and route of a thief spotted from the watchtower. He owned a voice so large and clear that every time he gave the alarm, the entire neighborhood became instantly involved in the pursuit and capture of the thief. Often all Chink and Freckleface had to do was follow along the pathway in the street that the crowd opened up for them and run directly down the alley people pointed at, enter the basement door indicated by an old woman with her chin, cross into the corner of the basement that stood exposed by a watchman with a flashlight, where Chink would take out the gun Freckleface had given him and fire two bullets neatly into the man's head. That was Chink's specialty, shooting. And he did seem to believe that God did the killing, he only did the shooting. Freckleface's specialty might be called brokerage. It was he who unclamped the dead thief's fingers from the stolen money and delivered it back to the shop owner or pedestrian who'd been robbed, and he, therefore, who negotiated the price of the return, who divided the fee three ways. And when it became clear that if they wished, they could expand their business to other neighborhoods in the gully, it was Freckleface who arranged to have the new lookout towers built, he who hired the new lookouts, shooters and collectors, and he who knew to put Tarzan in charge of all the lookouts and train them to cup their hands just so and call out exactly, clearly, as loud as a siren, where the thieves were running to. It was Freckleface who put Chink in charge of procuring weapons for the shooters and training them to use their guns efficiently and responsibly, and of course it was he who trained the collectors, implemented the commission system based on the system used by the bus company, and kept track of all the records. By now, Tarzan owned his own house on the Heights, where he liked to throw wild, lavish parties by the pool, and Chink lived in a condominium on the waterfront where he kept a 40-foot cabin cruiser anchored year-round, and Freckleface was sleeping with the daughter of the Prime Minister. They had come a long ways from the gully and did not believe that they would ever have to return, especially Freckleface, who had made a whole new set of friends who called him Naldo and barely knew where in the city the gully was located. Sometimes, though, late at night, Freckleface would rise up from the bed he shared with the daughter of the Prime Minister, and he'd cross the parquet floor to the louvered doors that led to the terrace. And out on the terrace in the silvery moonlight, he'd lean over the balustrade, light a cigarette, and look down and across the sleeping city all the way to the gully. He'd stand there till dawn, smoking and waiting for the sun to come up and for the people down in the gully to come out of their shanties and go for water, start up their cook fires, head down to the waterfront looking for work, or out to the airport to panhandle tourists, or over to Central Square just to hang out in the shade of the mimosa trees. Freckleface, miles away, up on his terrace, wearing a blue silk robe and smoking French cigarettes, would say over and over to himself, as if it were a magical charm, an incantation, "I don't live there anymore, and no one I know lives there. The people who go on living there must want to live there, or they'd leave that place. Look at Tarzan. Look at Chink. Look at me." Then he'd go inside, shower, shave, and dress, and walk downstairs for breakfast, where the first thing he'd do was read the morning newspaper for the names and addresses of thieves shot by his men last night in the gully. After breakfast, he'd drive out in his brown Mercedes and call on the families of the dead thieves, offering first his condolences and then his card, and a special cut-rate coffin and burial service from his Our Lady of the Gully funeral parlor chain. Later on, he'd drop by the office and go over the figures. After that, lunch. Then a workout and a massage. Then, who knows, real estate maybe. Import-export. Hotels. Life is certainly surprising, he'd think.
That was Russell Banks reading his story, The Gully, from Success Stories. Banks was recorded in Iowa City, Iowa, earlier this year by the co-editor of the forthcoming New Letters Review of Books, Trish Reeves. Banks says the type of success attained by Freckleface, Chink, and Tarzan isn't really any different from anyone else's success.
I thought, well, you know, the way this is a description of how everybody gets ahead if you're going to get out of the ghetto. This is what everyone advises you to do. They don't ever advise you to become a better person. And given what resources they have available to them, they get ahead just the way most people get ahead coming up out of the ghetto in any place in the world.
Often it seems like you locate the place, but not the name. We often don't know the name of your characters, or it's an assumed name.
Well, this is a typical of a number of stories in this new book, in that half the stories are very realistic, conventionally realistic, I should say, in their narrative mode and formats. And so they use a lot of the devices of realism. The other half of the stories are more like political fables or allegories, and they have a different kind of intention. So they use different means. And one of those means is to sort of reach for emblematic and generic characters and use them in a way a morality play or something might use them, rather than to specify the same way. Different kinds of specifications, so you can deal more easily with the abstract qualities of the story, the moral or whatever qualities of the story. So the part of the structure of the book is based on the tension between the two kinds of truth.
What you write, both short stories and novels, what is your favorite genre to work in, or does it just vary? And how do you decide what an idea is going to become?
It's almost physiological for me. I have, now that I've been at this long enough, I can look back and see patterns. And I can see that usually what happens is I'll write a novel and then just feel sort of depleted in ways that won't permit me to write another novel right away, but I still want to go on writing. And it's not by any means by conscious intent or preferring one form over another. I like both of them equally and differently. Short stories to me are not short novels or something like that. They're very different beasts. It's like writing poetry or painting or something compared to novels. They really don't seem to bear the same relation at all for me to the world, so I really engage the form differently.
Why do you write?
That's the question that I never seem to be able to answer the same way twice. It's a very hard question to answer the same way twice, probably because one doesn't write the same for the same reasons twice. I think
I began to write in the beginning for reasons that are had to do with a simple desire to be a writer. I had fallen in love with literature. As I think Flannery O'Connor said, literature attracts literature. And that it was because of literature that I wanted to, well, I want to be one of those people who thrilled me, so I want to thrill others the same way. And so, which is in some important way, all the important ways perhaps, the wrong reason to write. And if that's all you want, and that's the only reason you want to write, you don't do it for very long. But we always seem to start things for the wrong reasons and then later on straighten out what our reasons are for doing it. And so as time went by, of course, and then I began to write, I continued to write simply because it seemed I had to write in order to maintain my own clarity, such as it was in the world. Whatever knowledge I could have about the world of fact and value, I could only seem to get through writing, through the discipline and rigors of writing fiction particularly. So it goes on for, I suppose, those reasons, because it's a route, an access route for me towards something like clarity in the world of fact and value. It's how I have learned to know anything about the world.
Russell Banks was interviewed by Trish Reeves at WSUI in Iowa City, Iowa. His new book is Success Stories. The New Letters Review of Books issue featuring Trish Reeves' full interview with Russell Banks will be released soon. For information on receiving the review, which is free with New Letters Magazine subscriptions, write us at New Letters on the Air, care of KCUR-FM, 5100 Rock Hill, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Cassette copies of most New Letters on the Air programs can be obtained for $7.50. Our address again, New Letters on the Air, care of KCUR-FM, 5100 Rock Hill, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. David Ray founded New Letters on the Air. Today's program was engineered by Kevin Danner at KCUR-FM in Kansas City. Producers for our show are Rebecca Presson and Judy Ray. Thanks to the Missouri Arts Council for financial support. Promo for next week. On the next New Letters on the Air, we'll hear poems about women in history. Ruth Whitman reads her poems about Tamsin Donner of the ill-fated party of pioneers brought to cannibalism during its cross to California, and about Hannah Senish, the World War II heroine who parachuted into Balkan country to help escaping Jews. Our best poets come to public radio from New Letters on the Air.